Okay. I open up the House Committee on Human Services today, February 10th, 2010. And I open up an informational hearing, an update on child welfare and critical incident report team. Erin Kelly Steele and whomever else. And we've got a slideshow this morning.
Good morning, Member Chair Tomei, Vice Chair Olson, representatives of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Kelly Steele, and I am the Director of the Children, Adults, and Families Division. I'm an Assistant Director to Dr. Bruce Goldberg in the Department of Human Services. And with me today is Lois Day. She is the Administrator of our Office for Safety and Permanency for Children, which is a fancy way of saying our Child Welfare Program Office. And we very much appreciate the opportunity to be here and to give you an update on some things that we have spoken with you about before, and also some things that have happened since last you were here. I'm hoping I can figure out how this is working. My intuition was not right. Okay. So what we tried to do with this PowerPoint was focus on a couple of things. One, there were some questions about some recent reports that we've done regarding critical incidents that have occurred in our system. And it felt important to also share with you some updated data and information about how our system's working and who we're serving in child welfare. And if you remember, in the Children, Adults, and Families Division, we have three major program areas. We have vocational rehabilitation for adults with disabilities, and then we have really what I consider to be kind of a continuum of safety services for parents and kids. We have our self-sufficiency programs that provide services to low-income families and their children, and then we have the child welfare program that, as you know, statutorily we intervene when a child has already been hurt. That's when our authority kicks in. I think it's just important to mention a couple things in terms of context. We continue to be challenged in the state around the area of child abuse prevention. There are things that we know that we can do to prevent children from being hurt and being abused and neglected. And although we've made some pretty really remarkable strides, particularly in 2007 when we redesigned the TANF program and we made investments in mental health and addiction services and we targeted some of those investments to parents in our system, we continue to struggle. I think you all know that. We do provide services in child welfare to children who are in their own homes with their parents and also to children who cannot be safely at home and are in foster care. Our in-home service capacity is much more limited than our foster care capacity is, and that's in large part driven by funding. States are on the hook primarily for providing funding to support in-home service delivery, and the federal government does kick in around a funding stream that's called Title IV-E, and largely that funding stream is, one, very outdated. It's driven by eligibility criteria that go all the way back to 1996 and welfare reform, but also it's really driven by custody belonging to the state and children being in out-of-home care. So there's an incentive there that I think our system is constantly struggling against and we're never motivated by, and our workers don't know when they're dealing with a family necessarily who is or isn't 4E eligible, but in large part because of the resources and whether we can safely address the needs of a family in their own home versus having to then take a child into care to be safe, those resources do become a dynamic in our system that we're constantly working against, because our belief as a system is we would rather, if we can safely do so, maintain a child's placement in their own home with their parents. But as I say, our resources to support that safety, which is critical for our system, are very, very limited. And I think it's really important, and you all really probably appreciate this very much, that it's not just our capacity in child welfare that is really stretched in this area, but really the courts, the attorneys, service providers, others upon whom we depend to serve these children and families are also under-resourced. So you have a system that is very, very, that is really maxed out in terms of our ability to meet families' needs and to do the things that we know we should be doing. Let's see. Wanted just to provide you a bit of an update. I won't go through all of the data here. I think I now have, okay. In 2009, we had over 67,800 calls reporting abuse and neglect. That's up from the year before. We referred for investigation around 28,580 of those, and we confirmed 11,090 unduplicated victims, child victims of abuse and neglect in 2009. Again, that's a higher number than we had confirmed in 2008. There are about 870,000 children in Oregon, and about 13,290 of them spent at least one day in foster care in 2009. That represents about 1.5% of all the children in Oregon. On any given day, that number is lower, so that 13,000 number is kind of any one day in the year. So those other numbers are there for you as well. Most of our children in child welfare continue to be reunified with their parents when they leave our system. The number has gone down slightly from the year before. We also move children into other permanent arrangements like adoption and guardianship when we're not able to reunify with them with their parents, and those numbers are there for you. Alcohol and drug abuse continues to be the largest single driver when it comes to abuse and neglect in this state, but a close second is domestic violence, and we'll talk about that a little bit more as we move forward in our system's efforts to address that. Of the children served in foster care, we want to highlight a few things in terms of their race and ethnicity, because our system continues to struggle with the overrepresentation of Native American and African American children in our care, and it's one of our goals to be able to serve those families better. And you can see here the statistics in terms of the numbers that they represent in the system. Just for perspective, while 8.8% were Native American, in the total population, the number of Native Americans in the state is about 1.9%. And in terms of the African American community, the number of children in foster care was about 8.3% that were African American. Throughout the state, the African American community represents about 4% of our population. So that's where we get to that overrepresentation issue. We're comparing it to the percentage that those families represent in the general population as compared to the percentage they represent in foster care. We do serve older youth in foster care, and again, an area where we're under-resourced but we have, I think, here shown that we're leveraging those resources better. The only resources in our system to support transition services for older youth come to the state from the federal government. The state has never invested state resources in independent living services, and the last I checked, we were able to serve about 30% of our kids who are transitioning out of foster care into independent living arrangements. That is, again, a woefully inadequate place in terms of our resource base in our system, because that's a really critical step into independence for our children and young people who have unfortunately grown up in foster care or who come to foster care later in their life experience. Our system is one that is often reacting. We are in a place where it's really appropriate for us to be reacting to things like the increase of use of methamphetamine, some of the other drivers in our communities that we need to be responsive to. And at the same time, we know that we have things that we should be doing, need to be doing for kids. So one of the things that we have done and really fully began to implement in 2009 was to set a very proactive strategic agenda around the areas where we see our greatest need for growth and improvement, but also want to be able to be disciplined and kind of sustain an improvement effort where we're very deliberate about the strategies that we're putting in place and the things that we're trying to do that we know will work best for the children we serve and for their families. So we have two primary areas where we've set goals. One is around the safe and equitable reduction of children in foster care. Oregon continues to have one of the highest placement rates of children in foster care in the country. We're almost double the rest of the country in terms of the average. And we have continued to look to see, you know, really why is that? What is it that is going on for Oregon that isn't happening in other states? And I think in large part our conclusion has been that other states often have different kinds of support systems on the front end that Oregon doesn't have that support some of those safety issues in the home that we don't currently have the resources to support in our communities. But there are other issues that are unique to us, and I've had several law enforcement officers tell me, well, maybe Oregon's actually getting it right, Aaron. Maybe the rest of the country is wrong. I guess that's one way to look at it. But no matter, you know, which way you approach this, for us, again, the value is in family, in community. And our hope is that a child's experience with the child welfare system is a temporary one, as long as they can be, you know, we can assure that they're safe in their own homes or with a family member. And so we've set a series of goals around the safe and equitable reduction, not driven by economics at all, but driven by what we believe to be best for our kids. One of the interesting statistics that I think is always fascinating is that about 25% of our kids, and that's a very rough number, it may be slightly lower than that, but about 25% of kids who come into foster care actually return home within the first 3 months of coming into care. So one of the things we're challenging ourselves with is, what is it that we can do to hopefully avoid that three-month very traumatic experience of removal and then placement with somebody they don't know or maybe hopefully a relative if we're doing our work well? How can we avoid that in the first place and really focus on safely keeping kids in their own homes? We're also looking at eliminating the disparate treatment and overrepresentation of children of color. We've had for years an expectation that our services are culturally competent. The way we've done this in the past is not working. We are putting in place a series of strategies that we hope will be much more effective in this regard, and I'm very proud to say the court system, which I think this group understands very well, no child enters or exits foster care, state custody, without the approval of the court system. And the court system is very much supportive of all of these goals that we're working on, and especially is taking some steps in their own process to look at the issue of disparities. This is an issue that is present for kids, not just in child welfare, but also in juvenile justice. And so the courts have been talking, and Oregon's been talking about overrepresentation in the juvenile justice system for quite a while. So we're learning from that conversation and applying it and strengthening it in the dependency child welfare arena as well. We're working very hard. This comes from a strong policy message from this body to increase placements and connections with family for kids who cannot be safely at home with their parents. You all have taken a series of steps, which you know very well, in the last several years to strengthen the statutory framework that requires us to work with relatives, place with relatives, do whatever it is that we can, go beyond the reasonable efforts expectation even, that is the federal standard in child welfare, to be connecting children to their families. That is absolutely the right approach, and it is for a variety of reasons. One is that research shows that children who are not at home with their parents are safer when they're placed with relatives. Their outcomes are better. They're more connected to their families and their culture. And it's absolutely the right thing to do. And you'll see that when we talk about strategies, it goes throughout our plan, and it affects all of these other things that we're talking about. We're also looking to increase the number of children who leave foster care, either to reunite with their families or to be adopted and have permanent guardianship, some sort of permanency so that they're not in limbo in the foster care system. And all of this is done under the umbrella of safety. And we have a very specific measurement that we're watching very closely to make sure that we're not making decisions at the expense of children being safe. That's absolutely not what this is about. We also are trying to make sure that the decisions that we make equitably affect all of the kids in our system, because although we have seen actually a foster care reduction in the state overall of over 20% in the last 4 years, that reduction hasn't happened in an equitable way. Kids of color continue to be overrepresented in our system, and so that tells me we've got to be much more deliberate about making sure that our safe reduction efforts are equitably dispersed across populations. And by the way, although we feel very good about that 20% reduction, because the rate of reabuse, so kids that we know who have been hurt, who get hurt again, is actually declining. So kids are safer, and fewer of them are being served in the foster care system right now in Oregon. The next set of goals that we have, apparently I am, okay. I keep thinking I've discovered the key to this, and there we go. Is focused on the children that we do serve. We believe, see, it catches up with me a little bit. I'm going too fast for it, I think. We really believe that foster care is an important part of the safety continuum for kids. Unfortunately, I would love there to be a day when there is no need for there to be foster care, but that is not our objective around our safe foster care reduction. And we do have some very clear objectives for our foster care system with respect to it, the services that we provide on behalf of children and their families. The relative piece crosses over into this goal set in terms of safety and all of those other things, but very specifically, we want to make sure that kids who are in foster care are not hurt, and we want to make sure that we're able to meet their physical and behavioral health needs. One of the things that we know is that kids cannot be successful in their school environment, they cannot be successful in their home environment, and it's very difficult for them to be safe with their family or with anyone else if their own behavioral health issues are not being addressed. And so we have a very deliberate effort that we're undertaking in partnership with the medical community and the mental health community to serve our kids in foster care better and enhance the service we provide to them so that hopefully as they transition to family, to caregivers, to parents, what goes with them is also this better and improved mental health situation and the services that support that.
Well, Erin is taking a breath. Colleagues, I'm going to ask you to hold your questions, and you can write yourself a note on here and put it maybe on the page that you've got a question about so that when Erin is through with this presentation, we'll ask questions. Thank you, Erin.
Thank you. So I wanted to point out a couple of ways that we know that our strategic and focused efforts are actually getting results. This group I know heard about the 2007 review the federal government came and did, and they published the results of that review in 2008, and it showed that Oregon, like every state in the country that's been reviewed, is not meeting the federal standards in terms of expectations and outcomes for their for our foster care system. We put in place a program improvement plan, as has every state, and we have already, just in the first three quarters, it's a six-quarter plan, in the first three quarters of our program improvement plan, we have met five of the six goals, and we're showing improvement on the sixth. So you can see here, I already mentioned that the repeat abuse, they look at it on the flip side, how few children are being re-abused, the absence of maltreatment recurrence, the absence of abuse in foster care, fewer children are being abused and neglected in care in Oregon, the timeliness, how more children are returning sooner and safely to their parents, more children who are free to be adopted are being adopted sooner. Our efforts to help children who've been in care for too long are yielding results. I put an example there in terms of Multnomah County and some effort that they're making for kids who've been actually placed in what they call long-term foster care, sort of a shorthand for it. It's actually a little bit more complicated than that. But we're really trying to be deliberate about moving those children into plans that look at other alternatives, not just a permanent situation in foster care. And then the stability of foster placement, that's the one where we still have not met the PIP goal or the national composite measure. That has to do with how many moves foster children have in their first year in placement. We are showing improvement in that area, but we have a little ways to go to meet the goal. But I just thought it was important to acknowledge that we've got another series of what we call dashboard measures in child welfare that we regularly monitor in terms of how often our staff are getting out and seeing kids face-to-face, how timely our response is to child protective services assessments and phone calls we get about abuse, our efforts to get children referred for mental health assessments within 21 days, our efforts around disproportionality and disparities. We have measurements for those things that we track, and we actually publish on the web every month. So if you're interested, you can see not just statewide, but also your district, how they're doing in terms of our what we call our dashboard. And I'd be happy to email that link over to Rick to send out to all of you if you're interested in seeing that. But we are trying to be very transparent with our data and our performance, and it's all on the web. So That's what our, that's the global look at our system, but we also have a process that looks at things that go wrong in our system. And we have made a commitment these last 5 years to be very transparent also about things when they go wrong in our system, what happened, and what it is that we're doing to respond and improve. We call this particular formal review, the child welfare system and nationally child welfare agencies do what they call case reviews, but very often those case reviews do not include external partners. They do not include very specific analysis around a particular case, and they also don't include, again, a publication on the web that reports out on what the findings of the review were. And when I was working for Governor Kulongoski in 2004, in response to some very difficult cases in the child welfare system, a team got together and created, including external partners, attorneys, CASAs, law enforcement, and others, and created what we call our critical incident response team process. So back in 2004, these got started. They were acknowledged in statute by the legislature in 2007. The purpose of the reviews is to very quickly, in some very demanding timelines, draw lessons from what occurred. And the criteria for calling one of these, and the person who's responsible for calling them is Dr. Goldberg, the head of the department. There is a set of mandatory criteria that says if a child died and that death was likely the result of abuse or neglect, and the child was either in our custody at the time that that death happened, or we'd had a call about that child or their family within the previous 12 months, it is mandatory that we convene what we call, we use the acronym CERT for these. So you'll hear, if I could, I'll just use that acronym. It's the Critical Incident Response Team, CERTs. So it's mandatory that we call a CERT in those instances. It's discretionary in instances where a child is seriously injured or has died and has had some contact in the past with our system. So the point is to be learning from, you know, what it is that we knew about that family, then ultimately the bad outcome that occurred, and what it is that we need to do differently in hopes that we can prevent that same situation from happening again. CERT reports deliberately review the agency actions. They identify systemic issues, and that's kind of a fancy way of looking at what is what happened in this case really happening in other cases too? Are there training issues for us, policy issues, practice issues that we need to be addressing as a result of this case? The reports make recommendations for improvement, and they too are all available on the web. CERT teams include both agency staff and external partners, and I put the numbers up in terms of CERTs per year. You'll see there was a dramatic increase in the number of CERTs in 2009, and that's a large part in reflection on the work of the 2008 CERT review group, which came out with Pete Shepard from the Department of Justice, who worked there at that time, chaired a group that also was inclusive of a lot of external partners and media partners, actually. Representative from the media community was on that group. And they made a series of recommendations to us about CERTs and how to strengthen the review process, our response to the reviews, and also our reporting out of that. But they commented that we needed to be calling more CERTs in the areas where we had discretion to do so. And so in 2009, we took that feedback very seriously, and we more frequently convened CERT teams in that year than any other. And all of those reports are on the web. We also had an audit of our CERTs, all the CERTs that had been done by our DHS internal audit group that is not part of my division but external to me and under Dr. Goldberg. And that CERT audit found that, in fact, child welfare had followed through on 143 out of the 144 recommended actions in the CERTs that they reviewed. There was one that was kind of unresolved that we're still getting our arms around. But what it said, it also made some recommendations very consistent with the other CERT review team recommendations for how we could strengthen and enhance our process, and we've been in the process of doing that over the past year. I wanted to give you some examples of the systemic issues that we identified in the 2009 CERTs, and these are not all of the issues by any means, but some of the things that we found, and we actually found sometimes more than once, which says to us these have to be part of our strategic improvement plan, and we have got to put in place some steps to make the changes that we're finding need to be made. The first one, comprehensiveness of assessments. We changed our practice model in the state in 2008. Lois can help me say this correctly, but we had some national experts come in, review the way that child welfare did its work, and they came back with a recommendation to us, which actually now is playing itself out across the country, that we really needed to become much more consistent in our practice across the state, that we needed to be much more intentional, we needed to focus on issues of safety, not just on the front end when we first get a call, but throughout a case so that we're looking at the safety of kids when they're in foster care, when they've returned home, et cetera. And they also shifted our focus when we evaluate whether or not abuse or neglect occurred, not just to look at the particular incident that we're responding to. So somebody calls in and says that I think that there's a child who's being hurt by their parents, and we go out and we review that call to see if it's in fact true. But they asked us, they challenged us to be much more comprehensive in our approach. So we call this comprehensiveness as opposed to incident-based. So my simple way of looking at this is that instead of just saying yes or no, thumbs up, thumbs down, we think that the call we got and that we think this abuse actually is or isn't happening, that we have to really go far beyond that. And we have to say, is this child safe in their circumstances? Is there something else going on here? And we rely on collateral sources and others to get at that information. We have been finding consistently that change in our practice model that we expected, and this was just as recently as 2008, is one that our field continues to struggle with, our staff continue to struggle with. And so it's something that we, in different certs, have paid very close attention to. We find that it's continues to be a struggle. And you'll see when I talk a little bit about the specific cert that was most recent for our agency, that it's present yet again, and we're working on actually bringing out some. The same team that came out and helped us develop the model, we've asked them to come back out and look at, you know, are we in the right place in terms of our evolution and our training and our expectations of staff, or is there more we should be doing? Do you want to comment a little bit about comprehensiveness?
I can. I think that Aaron's just...
Introduce yourself, please.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. Representative Tomei, or Chair Tomei, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Boone, my name, and the rest of the committee, my name is Lois Day. I'm the Administrator of the Office of Safety and Permanency for Children. In describing the switch in our the way we address families when we go out and do investigations, our past model was to be incident-based. We went out and looked at, after a screening process where we took into account any past history we had or collateral calls that had come in about a family, we would go out and look at the family in terms of the incident that just occurred to determine if the child's safe, if the family needed services and needed to be involved with us. The switch we made to the Oregon safety model was, as Aaron described, we began to look at safety throughout the life of the case and throughout the life of our involvement with a particular family. So when they were, after an appropriate screening and when a worker goes out into the field, their first charge is to create safety for the child at the least intrusive level possible. So if safety can be achieved by the child remaining in the home, they'll do that. If the only way to achieve safety for the child in that given setting is to temporarily place them in foster care, that's what the worker's to do. But that's not the end of the investigation. At that point, the worker's to conduct what we call a comprehensive assessment, taking into account past history, the collateral contacts, contacts with other members of the community that are involved with the child, medical, educational, and any additional services or involvement that the family has, and create a plan for that family that addresses the issues that were driving the incident of abuse while keeping the child safe. So it's a different way of approaching families. It's a more, we believe, a more help-based way of approaching families than incident-based assessments, and it takes time and focus, frankly, on the part of the individual heading out into the field and those that support them back in the office when engaging that family.
Thank you. Yeah. So that's one of the issues, as I said, that in certs last year, we recognize that we need to continue to focus on, and we have a series of strategies for doing that, one of which I'll we'll talk a little more about. Agency work with teen parents. We had certs last year that showed us that sometimes we are called out to respond to concerns about a child. The child happens to be the child of a teen parent, and one of the things that we've struggled with is the how to address the safety, not just of the child about whom we got the call, but of the young person who is that child's parent. And that is something that's complicated in these situations and was something that came out of our cert review process last year. One of the conversations, and I believe we testified about these sets of reports involving some very serious abuse in foster care. One of the significant systems issues that we've identified is the need to strengthen, systematize our communication across the different kinds of staff that we have. We have staff that are assigned to respond to calls about abuse and neglect, and we have usually, I mean, in some small communities, this is all the same couple of people, but we also then have staff that are assigned to work on, for instance, certifying foster parents. And some communities have done really excellent work to make sure that if a call of abuse comes in about a child, that the information about that call is actually also then going to, about a child who is in foster care, that the information about that call is actually also going to the person responsible for certifying that foster parent, so that even if the call doesn't rise to the level of abuse or neglect, that we're following through in terms of our certification expectations with a foster parent. And so we had a series of reviews and have had in place a foster care safety team these last several months, which would be, this would take up an entire informational hearing in and of itself, but we'd be happy to come back and report to you on. I've never seen a work group go as deep as this group has gone. They had 90 days. They've reviewed hundreds of our foster care abuse cases, hundreds of reports about kids who are in foster care. They've come up with a series of recommendations, and we're now building into our work plan around safety in foster care, one of our main goals, the recommendations this group is making. Domestic violence. I mentioned earlier one of our key challenges that families in the state currently are facing. I think this group is very aware that even as recently as the last holiday season, we had 13 people in the state who were murdered or killed themselves as part of domestic violence related incidents, and it happened in very close sequence. So it stood out. But in my more recent review of some of the data, unfortunately, this is not that uncommon. We just happen to know about these particular cases because of the publicity surrounding them. We track domestic violence as it impacts the families that we're and the children that we are getting calls about, and we have revised our policy internally with respect to responding to domestic violence incidents and child welfare's interaction with those families. This is a very difficult area because, as you might imagine, when there's a parent who is the victim of domestic violence, being battered and in that power and control situation with their partner, we are always trying to avoid the balance. Our primary responsibility is to keep the child safe, and the child's being exposed to domestic violence sometimes in the home. But also we have lots of conversation with our system among ourselves and with our law enforcement partners about not then punishing the victim of the abuse by removing the children. Usually it's a woman from her care. And so we have to figure out the complexity around how to evaluate and respond to domestic violence-related child abuse and still try and be supportive of victims, survivors of that abuse, getting the help they need to protect their own children. It continues to be a challenge for us. It's something that came through in a couple of the certs last year, and we are working in close partnership with some of our domestic violence nonprofits and supporters also around training and issues so that we can continue to enhance our system's response when that very complex situation presents itself. We also had one case last year, again, kind of this cross-systems issues, where we had some parents who were also delayed developmentally, who what we found in this particular cert, they were being served by the developmental disability system. And in that system, people have both advocates and service providers. And what we found was that our staff were confused about who, you know, what it means to be an advocate for a parent with a developmental disability versus a service provider, and upon whom we depend on somebody, you know, whose opinion we depend on to help us make our safety assessment. And we also had some really rich conversation with the DD system about, you know, their value that people who are developmentally delayed can be good parents and can actively parent, and our concerns that sometimes those parents struggle with really basically meeting the needs of their kids, bathing, leaving children unattended in bathtubs that are too young to be unattended, those kinds of things. This is a really difficult area. So what I tried to do by just highlighting these is show that, you know, these are very, very complex cases that unfortunately some very difficult circumstances kind of elevated to our attention, and we are wrestling through them, not by ourselves, but in partnership with others, including law enforcement, district attorneys, other systems that are involved with these families, and outside experts in some cases. So one of the most difficult cases that I think many of us have had a chance to know about actually happened in December of last year, and it's our most recent cert that was published, and in response to Chair Tomei's request, I wanted to include information about that review, what it found and what we're doing in response. This involved an abuse-related fatality. We had a previous call about this child within 12 months of the fatality itself, so this was a mandatory cert situation for our organization. The cert team conducted its review, and there are very strict timelines for those review processes and report outs, and within 30 days, the first 30-day timeline published its first report in terms of what it found. What it found was that our system had information about this family that we did not adequately consider. And it found that we, in summary, that we had, unfortunately, not appropriately evaluated particularly the issue of this child's age as it related to her ability to protect herself. So the system issues that report called out that are still under review because we're still in the middle of our cert timeline really focused again on that issue of the comprehensiveness of both our screening when we receive calls about reporting abuse and neglect. And then also, we have in place a check and balance system very much in child welfare. The goal is that people are, no one is making decisions on their own, some of the most critical decisions, and we have supervisors who are trained and who are expected to be following through and signing off on some of the most important decisions, on the most important decisions that we make. In this particular case, we found that we need to really take a second look at how much time and how thorough the supervisory sign-offs are in terms of our work and with our staff. We found that this issue of children being isolated, having fewer contacts with traditional supports like schools, like the medical community, like the faith community, other eyes and ears, adults that may see the child other than their own caregivers, is a difficult one that we are asking ourselves whether when we get a call and we have information that tells us that a child is more isolated, is there something in particular we need to do different in response to that information? We also are looking at the issue of age and how it is being applied with respect to the decisions that our workers make when they screen calls or when they respond and evaluate comprehensively whether abuse or neglect that was reported occurred. In our policy and in our training, there is language that says regardless of age, these are things that you need to be considering. But when I've been even in follow-up on this report out in the field, it's pretty clear that our staff are struggle in this area, and this is a very historic issue in child welfare. The thinking a long time ago was that if you were old enough, you could run away, or you could report to somebody that something bad was happened to you, and we've really changed our practice I think to look differently at that, and when we've done some historic look at our data, the number we're going out as frequently as we over the last several years, as some of these adjustments to our policies have been made, we continue to respond to calls about children who are older in our system. It's not they are represented in our system sometimes for too long. But I think we're kind of needing, the CERT tells us that we need to go back and reevaluate our training, the wording in our policy, and really figure out, was it just this case where this happened to be a challenge, or is it really happening in other cases too? And we want to make sure, because the publicity around this case has suggested to us that that there may have been calls that our system doesn't show us that we received. We have done, as part of the CERT, we did a very thorough internal investigation of all the calls that we received about abuse and neglect, and it's our belief that we have found all of those calls, but there are a couple of additional steps that we plan to take to be certain the department didn't receive calls of abuse and neglect that we didn't record. So these are the next steps that the CERT team has identified as critical in response to this CERT. I mentioned already that some consultation with the very group that came out and helped us articulate the policy we now have around comprehensive assessment and screening. We're working with them again to see where are we, what do we need to do differently, how can we continue to strengthen our work in this area. We are seeking some consultation with some medical child abuse specialists to help us evaluate our assessment process. When we do have information that tells us that a child is more isolated, what is it that we can do together in partnership with other systems that frequently interact with children, and how can we be asking questions differently or be responding differently as we need to if those community supports that are traditionally part of children's lives are not there. And we're also doing an audit of cases other than this one to see how the issue of age is impacting our decision-making, both when we get a phone call and also then when we go out and we investigate. And the purpose of the audit is to see, as I said earlier, is this actually happening in other cases, or was the issue here unique to this case? Which kind of brings me to the last thing that I did want to say about the CERTs, and then I want Lois to talk about some of what our key focus areas are this year, and then we'll open it for questions. But the CERT process is focusing on systemic issues. We also have a separate internal process to look at individual performance when things go wrong. And the reason for that is that it's very important, I think, to our system that we not set in motion a series of improvements that are really responding only to the challenges that a couple of people are having in a particular area. We've actually had pretty negative experience in the past of that having occurred. So in other words, if I make the choice to I can't think of a really good example, but we want to separate the issue of an individual case and an individual and the people that were involved in that case from whether or not an issue was in fact systemic. And that's a tough conversation for our organization for a variety of reasons. Our staff work very, very hard. They work hard under very, very difficult circumstances, and when something like this goes wrong, it has a very significant impact, not just on the staff that were involved in a particular case and had the conversations that we now know that they had, but also for all of their coworkers that are working around them in that local office, and quite frankly, all across the state. As you might imagine, after you do this for a little while, sometimes these cases that are so bad trigger in each of us that see them a different response and remind us of things that either we have experienced before or things maybe that we've kind of suppressed. So we've been having a pretty intense discussion internally both about, what happened in terms of the performance in this case. Did it meet our standard of care? Did it follow our policy? Were people following our policy? And we've also been having a pretty intense discussion about our own agency's response to trauma in support of our staff and what it is that we do to care for our staff when we go through traumatic events like this, and how we meet the needs of the people who are doing this work every day. So there are a variety of responses to bad outcome cases. There's the CERT response, there's the individual performance review, and we're building in place a more systematic approach to really caregiving for our staff. And then there's caregiving that goes on also in the community that our staff need to be a part of, and that often involves our law enforcement and other partners in terms of multidisciplinary teams and trauma response. And it's just this case in particular, I think, is teaching us a lot of things far beyond what even the CERT report, which is pretty thorough at this end, we will continue to enhance, shows. And I just wanted to mention those things to you all. I want to turn it over to Lois now just to kind of show you how we integrate the CERT findings into the strategic plan that we had, the goals that we have, and talk about some of the things we're working on in 2010, and then we'll open it up for questions. So does that work? Just a couple more minutes?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. The Office of Safety and Permanency is comprised of six program areas. It's Child Protective Services, the foster care system, adoptions and guardianship, family-based services, residential treatment and licensing, and then technical services such as interstate compact and criminal record checks. We don't do the actual criminal records checks, but we have someone in our office that coordinates with that organization. All of those six areas have the same goals that Aaron described earlier in the presentation, and so I just want to highlight some of the things we're doing in those six areas to further those goals. The first is to safely prevent the entry of children into care, which equates with keeping children safely with their parents when there's difficulties that call them to our attention. Our family-based service program, we're redesigning the contracts we have there to be more focused on individual in-home services that can address parental difficulties and specific to their family and the issues that are arising in that family, in hopes that the children can stay while the parent is learning in a safe environment and not enter the foster care system. The second focus we have is on our new relative search and engagement policy, which is increasing our search for relatives and individuals that are significant to children who come into care and making more placements with them. And then if placement's not possible, maintaining those family connections that children need as they move temporarily through the foster care system. And a third is that our engagement again with the National Resource Center on Child Protective Services to help us look at our safety model and how we're applying it. Aaron spoke earlier about some of the issues that we found in this most recent CERT, and part of it is the issue of vulnerability and when that's assessed for a child. The way our model's designed, vulnerability of a child can never be really determined without a face-to-face contact with that child, because as you all are, I'm sure, aware, you know, one 10-year-old is very different than another 10-year-old based on the circumstances that surround that child as well as the abilities that child's developed over time. So in our screening process, we have an assessment of vulnerability, but the assessment isn't of the child's vulnerability. Rather, it's an assessment of why the caller believes this particular child is vulnerable at that time. Then our assessment, assessment of vulnerability is to occur in the face-to-face contact that another worker makes with the family. So part of bringing in the National Resource Centers to help us really help staff look at those sort of finer points of our model to ensure that we're applying it in the way that it was intended, so that we can have better outcomes. The second goal is to safely have children exiting foster care. Again, Aaron spoke to the temporary nature of foster care. It's sort of the most intrusive safety measure we can take for a child, removing them from their home and putting them in our system. And it's most effective when it's short, focused, services come to bear, and that child can then move out of our system into a permanent arrangement, preferably back with the parent, but if not, some other permanent arrangement. So our goal is really to keep the foster care experience only as long as necessary to ensure a safe, permanent placement for a child where they can grow and develop. So getting children out of foster care is as important as not bringing them in essence. And some of the efforts we have around that are, again, the relative engagement and search that we're doing. We're changing some of our policy around plans that are only germane in foster care. So that's that we call them APLAs, which are alternative planned permanent living arrangements. Long-term foster care is one of those plans. It's our least permanent type of plan for a child, and so we've changed the rules so that it has to be looked at again and again, in essence, on an annual basis. You have to look at that plan to determine if a higher level of permanency is possible for that child. Circumstances change. Children grow, develop. Parents grow and develop in ways we might not anticipate, and sometimes we're able to return children that originally, when we put that plan in place, we didn't think was possible. So that's one of the changes we're hoping are going to move children out of foster care that have been in there longer than is necessary. In partnership with the Casey Foundation, we're starting permanency roundtables. And what these are, an effort to do, to look at these cases where we have an APLA plan in place in a more comprehensive way with more eyes on it than just the caseworker and supervisor that manage that plan, to see if we can come up with some innovative plans, see if we've missed anything, to try and move these children into a higher level of permanency. ORCIDS is our new SACWIS, federal SACWIS computer system. It's being implemented this year. That is going to give us the ability to document and record information about children we haven't had in our current system, including incidences of abuse in foster care as it relates to the foster parent versus to the child. Currently, our system documents incidences of abuse by the birth family or the family the child was removed from. It's going to give us the ability to sort of crosswalk between different systems and placements that we didn't have in the past. And the Hague implementation, this is a related to children who are placed adoptively either out of the country or children who come into the country and need some sort of assistance and permanent placement. Oregon has been in the front of many states around the country in getting a process in place that ensures safety and good connectedness with other countries when we need to place children out of country with relatives, generally with relatives. Our efforts around addressing the disproportionality in foster care, a large part is being led by the task force that was is reporting out in October of this year. Our tribes have foster care reduction plans. We're planning training for our staff, and two of them here are noted, implicit bias and undoing racism, helping our staff understand how what they bring to the table can impact how we interact with cases, and that in turn impacts families and children. And the, again, relative engagement and our APLA policy changes and permanency. In terms of safety and foster care, Aaron referred to the foster care safety team. It was an excellent process. They have given us 32 individual recommendations to address in our system, and so in the coming year, we've begun already a preliminary plan of how to roll those recommendations into our work to address the issues that came out of that process. The Safe Home Study is an enhanced home study we're using to certify families that gives us a deeper look at dynamics within families that come to us to do foster care. And we're changing our foster care adoption recruitment contracts in part to also address the disproportionality and increase the number of foster homes we have that are culturally connected to the children that we're bringing into care. And finally, the health and mental health of children in foster
Lois,
care.
Lois, I'm going to stop you right there.
Yes, thank
it's
you.
It's clear we're not going to finish this okay. today. And colleagues, I think I apologize for not allowing questions as we went along, because my fear is we're going to lose those questions. I apologize to you, too, because we have a piece of legislation we're going to try to work on today. So what I'd like to do, I think you were talking with Nikki about perhaps coming back on Friday. Would that work for you?
Sure.
And so what I'd like to take just a few minutes now to let Aaron and Lois know what issues you want more elaboration on. You've got some questions. And I know Debbie had a question early on. And so what I'd like to do is just bring these questions out, and we'll try to deal with them more directly. Debbie, I'm going to start with you, and then I'm going to just go around, okay?
Okay.
So, Debbie?
And it was more with what Erin was talking about, and it's clear that you're working really hard to make improvements, and I appreciate that. A couple of statements that you made, I'd like to have a little more elaboration on. One, you set a goal to make the number of African Americans more equitable to the Caucasian, and I don't know how you, what you meant by that, because how can you assume where the abuse is going to lie? And then the other statement that kind of caught my attention was you mentioned hundreds of cases of abuse within a foster family, and that just, maybe I missed that in foster care, and that you were reviewing those, and that just seems a few I can see happen, but hundreds sounds a lot. And then finally, I just wondered if you've ever thought of, you know, when there's an abuse, you mentioned in domestic violence cases, of moving the perp out, not moving the kid out or disrupting the family, getting rid of the abuser, and in the case where it would be a parent or single parent, and have ever thought of, since you're having trouble finding more and more foster, where we have more and more kids needing foster care, have you ever thought of moving someone into the home so the kid stays home and you put somebody in there to care for them within their own home? So those are just the thoughts I have.
And I'm going to start with you and then just go around.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. And I want to thank the both of you for the work that you do for the children in our state. I know it's very difficult work at times. And, a bad outcome always brings to light just the very few bad parts of your agency and not all the good stuff. You spoke a little bit about the main reasons for people getting into foster care was drugs and alcohol abuse and domestic violence. I'm curious as to where and how the economy affects that dynamic, if it's, you know, more so when the economy's poor. And then you talked about partners around reporting and dealing with abuse reports. You did talk a little bit about your partnership with law enforcement around domestic violence, but you really didn't talk about your partnership just around the initial calls. And I guess my question would be, what's the policy when somebody calls and reports a domestic or a child abuse case? Do you contact law enforcement? Is there a connection made there? Or what level or what at what time is law enforcement contacted? Thank you.
Again, I'd like to reiterate Representative Freeman's comments about the job, the very, very difficult job that you have. But my concern, and if you can answer it later on, is how do you plan to change the process is with your CERT process, especially with older, with teens? And whether they're not as... Everyone's a priority, but a 5-year-old versus a 15-year-old. And so I just wonder what process you're going to put in place.
Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. We have double the rate of children in foster care in Oregon. And you talked about front-end services in other states that are absent. And how are you evaluating that benefit to diverting resources to front-end services in order to reduce kids in foster care? And the other question is, I think, a little more difficult, but who's in the CERT, the latest CERT, who's held accountable? And was, in fact, anybody relieved of employment as a result of this case?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, Representative Maurer was talking about, I would be interested in that same information. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. I think I have a sort of a different approach because of my background as a Head Start director and a member of the Children's Commission on Families. The case that you highlighted is a case that haunts me significantly because I ask myself, because of that community involvement we've had, and if I believe what the paper reported, a number of people already knew this. And so I've been asking myself, if I had been a member of that community and had seen what had been reported in the paper about this child, what would I have done to protect this child if I felt the agency wasn't responding as I thought. So I brought this up at the last commission meeting, and I'm not so sure I felt safe if I did that. So the question I have, because I do think if we want the community involved, it's not just agency. It's about the people who live in the community, and what can we do when we see something?
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Golly, we're loading you down.
Yeah, we are.
We have probably three hearings left. But I would be interested in hearing a little more about the partnerships, you know, with the counties, with the local entities, you know, just to make sure, you know, how do we make sure that things are not falling through the cracks? Just do a little more with that. Mm-hmm. And something about the, I know there exists a system of foster parent sort of support groups, and just about that as a resource to help monitor and train foster parents to good standards.
Thank you.
Your plate's full. I'll give you a pass.
You know, I wish I could, but I can't. All right. Thank you very much, Chair Tomei. I've got a whole list of issues and concerns, and we maybe want to take them offline at some point. But they start off with an issue of trust. You brought up the concern about the disproportionality. At some point, I hope every one of the representatives will get a chance to take a look at the state of Black Oregon, a report that came out earlier, just a few months ago. It has one whole section devoted to child welfare, one whole section basically devoted to foster children. It's an important section, and it brings up some of the statistics that you talked about. I think that the basic issue is a question of trust that we have seen, and we've seen the disproportionality has been for some time. It's easy to explain in some ways, if you wanted to go into looking at it in terms of a racial issue. With the Native American community, they for many years were told that their kids were going to be taken away from them no matter what, and they were. And they sort of expect that, so when they see anything regarding foster care or any sort of government activity with their children, they assume the worst because they've seen the worst. So I'm not surprised by that, and that's a trust factor. And I'm curious to see how you're able to not only talk about training in terms of implicit bias and undoing racism within staff, but also how you make sure that the context is there for the Native American community and the African American community, because in the same case, the African American community has a significant lack of trust that their children will be treated well or that their families will be treated well when they encounter the foster care system. And that's going back decades, decades. The issue really becomes another aspect, and I'd like to see if you would speak to the issue of decision trees as you make decisions about who's going to go into the system and who's not. You mentioned that a couple of times within this, but I would like to see a sense of whether you how you address that in terms of a culturally specific basis, if possible. On another issue, I'd like to see how you're dealing with, you mentioned the mental health services. We have a dearth of mental health services for kids. I think the last numbers that I looked at for Multnomah County was we had about 100,000 children in Multnomah County, and we had about 100 spaces available for young people. I may be wrong on those particular statistics, but I know we certainly do not have enough to deal with the number of kids that need the support. I'd like to have, if possible, some information about that. I'd also like to have a sense of the impact of the reduction in school counselors, child development specialists, and whether that has had an impact on the number of kids going into the system and who's going into the system. You had a child development specialist who were noted in the Portland schools for helping to decide how to address certain issues. Sometimes it was child abuse issues. But they were eliminated in many in the range of budget cuts that took place over the last now almost 20 years. That has had an impact clearly. I'm sorry that's just the start of my list. But
and Lou, I'm sorry, Representative. Maybe you could contact either Mickey or Aaron or staff, and if you have more issues, that you want addressed, we will certainly have them addressed, but
thank
maybe
you.
Do that offline.
That's, I will. Thank you.
Thank you. Great. And there was a situation of, I think several families belong to a church in Oregon City in particular, where I think that DHS is going to be involved in overseeing some of the health issues with those children. I'd like to hear about those. And you mentioned, Aaron, about looking at a yearly plan for children who've been in foster care for a long time to see, I think it was Aaron, talking about permanency every year. I'd like to know how that process works. And I had one more. I'd like to hear more about children going into independent living. And I'd like to hear, I think, whether or not children who are reaching 18, there, at least one legislator has mentioned to me that they thought that when a child reaches 18 and they're in foster care, that they're removed from foster care, they're removed from help, and I want to hear exactly about that. And I think that is it. And if we have other issues that you think of, colleagues,
well,
as you're looking
doing
through.
That last one. That's my another one I
yeah.
had to.
If you look through this and you bring up other things, please contact, as I see, either Mickey or Aaron and let them know there are other issues. To me, this is one of the most important issues that we deal with, and I think we may be the only committee that deals in depth with issues of children, especially those who are in foster care. So I want to make sure that we learn as much as we can so that we can help those children and help the agency to move forward. So what I've asked is that we had another program scheduled for Friday, and we're going to ask these folks to come back on Friday. If we need to, they'll come back a third time. We will follow up on this and make sure we have all the information that we need.
Here.
Thank you so much, and thanks for talking in great depth about these issues. Colleagues, we've contacted the speaker's office and let them know that we're going to be late because we have one bill that's coming before us, and I would like to move that bill today, if at all possible. So with that, I'm closing the informational hearing on child welfare and opening up a work session on House Bill 3692. So Rick has some more information. We do have a fiscal statement. Thank you. And we also have a letter, which you should have gotten already, from Bruce Goldberg that lets us know for sure. I asked for this. Go ahead.
Can you describe this a little bit?
Oh, yeah. That no money from this bill, from this legislation, will be going into DHS for their registry that they've asked for.
And just briefly, yes. This does create the 9-member traumatic brain injury strategic partnership, requires DHS to provide staff. The key to this is it does designate a $5 fee from the traffic citation to fund programs, and then the staff is the brain trust. There is the -1 amendments, which does allow the Oregon Health Authority to establish the registry, outlines the purpose of the registry, basically in research, and then specifies confidentiality. You do have a revenue and now a fiscal impact statement on the -1s, and this does have a letter from the speaker indicating this should go to Ways and Means.
Right, right. So we can call up anyone that you'd like to hear from. We can have discussion here, but I would like to pass this legislation today.
So are we in work session?
So we are in work session. Didn't I open? Yeah, I welcomed the work session. Mm-hmm. That's good. Now, okay.
Madam Chair, I just want to let you know, and I'm just looking at the fiscal now on the -1, that I will be a no on the -1. I will be a no on the bill. It's not taking money out of the $5. But it does appear to have a $714,000 fiscal, at least that's how I read it on page 2, midway down, expenditures from the Oregon Health Authority, and I can't support that. That's money coming from somebody within the Oregon Health Authority, and if they have too much money, they can give it back, and then we can reappropriate it. The other issue is the $5. We keep raising the fees. I mean, the TBI conversation is serious, but you know, it's another fee, and I just can't support it right now.
Okay, thank you, Representative. Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first thing I want to say is I do believe in the importance of what this legislation is trying to do. I believe this is a critical issue and that it should currently be funded by Department of Human Services. Last session, Department of Human Services got a $3.5 billion increase in their funding, but they could not carve out $1 million to help with this issue. So instead, what we're doing is we're looking at a $5 fee on fines, which could have a negative impact on the criminal fine and assessment account, which we use for public safety issues. My fear is when we increase fines, and traffic fines specifically, that less people will pay the fine and less citations will be issued because of fear of the amount of the fine by the officers. And those two things coupled could have an impact on providing public safety services, and the criminal fine and assessment account has legislative priorities for providing public safety, not human service needs. So for that reason, I will be voting no.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you. Anyone else wishes?
Well, Madam Chair, I'll throw my hat in to this. Thank you. I'll be opposed to the bill, too. It's not that I don't like the concept, because I think it's a very worthy concept. The problem for me gets down to the court issue, and having, like I had mentioned earlier this week, or last week, actually, on this whole thing, is that, in fact, meeting with five of the judges that I work with down in Linn County, circuit court judges, they're saying that, in fact, the volume of citations has really decreased because I asked the question about the surcharges that we added last year, the $35 and $45 respectively for criminal and traffic violations. And as a result, the estimated revenue has really been way down. So I'm just trying to kind of balance this out a little bit, thinking this might not be a good time right now to do the $5, is how I'm kind of looking at it.
Thank you. Anyone else who wishes to speak on this? Representative,
I guess Freeman. I don't understand Representative Freeman's comment about how law enforcement would be disinclined to add a fine. And I guess I also believe that it's also an awareness building issue. And I don't have a problem adding $5. That's a pack of cigarettes, from what I understand. And or a big latte or something like that, it's $5 is not a big deal. And if it raises awareness and it helps defray some of the incredible costs that their actions will actually impose on the victims, what's $5 in that sense? So, just rhetorical. I will be supporting this, and I'm happy to, and I think we need to do this. It's important.
Anyone else? Representative Van Orman.
Well, just an observation. One of the most interesting things is that I think brain injury is becoming much more, awareness is becoming much more prevalent. Being a sports mom, I'm watching ESPN the other night, and there's a football player who's being interviewed who's had two concussions, and talks about how they really need to be careful, they really need to be watched, and if they had another concussion, it could be he might not be able to speak to his children, he might not be able to do the things that he normally does now, so that when he does have a concussion, it is very important that he has help and he has recuperation time. So I do think that this is a prevalent issue, especially among children and adults in sports. And I just think that it's time for us to recognize this as a serious problem.
Thank you, Representative.
I just want to say with Representative Boone, am a little perplexed about the citation issue. You know, this is the second year that, you know, my experience, we've dealt with these issues, and I don't remember this coming up before. I realized last year we were talking about a $2 as opposed to $5, but, you know, to be honest, I don't really see a big difference there, and that $3 increase is going to, you know, change citation practice and is going to, you know, eviscerate the, you know, the court process. I just don't see that. So I found this a compelling process last year, and I remain supportive of it.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I just want to point out.
Let me see if anybody else has anything to say. Yes, Representative.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
No, I'm sorry. Okay. Representative Doherty.
Thank you. I will be brief because I always am. Maybe I'm a novice at this, but this doesn't make sense. These people have broken the law. They have been stopped by the police. They've been given a citation. I almost think that it should be more than a $5 fine on something like this, especially going to a program that is affecting so many more Oregonians, especially the National Guard guys that are coming back and don't have the services here to deal with their traumatic brain injuries. And so, as I say, it just doesn't make sense. These people broke the law. The fine should be higher, especially if it's going to a program like this.
Thank you. Oh, is there anyone who hasn't spoken who would like to speak?
I would just briefly. Thank you, Madam Chair. As a novice as well, and to some extent to this particular process, but to this particular issue and the appropriate way of dealing with it, this seems very, very effective. It provides us a way of making sure that people understand what the brain injury issues are, and how to address them, and how to get the resources available to address them. So I will be voting yes, enthusiastically.
Thank you. Briefly, Representative.
Madam Chair, this committee doesn't get it. I'm serious when I say that, and I don't mean to be disrespectful, but I served 29 years with the Oregon State Police. None of you have probably ever been out and written a citation to anybody. You've not been involved with the courts to see how they feel about it. They're tired of this legislative body directing them to have to keep doing this, 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 and this for assessments. It started with 03 session. Well, I'll stop there, but officers do take in consideration whether or not they issue a citation depending on how high the bail is. I can speak for that from personal experience. I mean, I ran a couple different patrol offices and I saw troopers do that. I think that speaks and supports the whole idea of why the volume is down right now. And so I'm just sharing that.
Thank you. Representative Freeman, yes.
I just want to qualify my statement since it was talked about by a few of the representatives. In my previous elected experience, I was a city council president, and part of our role and one of our employees was a municipal judge. And part of that role that I took on as council president was to learn about the judge, learn about the court, and how fines are paid to municipalities and to the state. State gets their money first. So when we impose this thing, I'll let you know, the state will get their money, cities and counties may not. It could actually be considered an unfunded mandate. And also through that process of watching officers make decisions on writing citations and doing many, many ride-alongs, it was obvious to me that the more severe the penalty became when we put the mandatory minimum in sentencing for citations, the less citations they're willing to write. And again, my fear is simple, that the criminal fine assessment account, which we use to provide public safety in the state of Oregon, if that account shrinks because of lack of citations or the lack of people paying for those citations, we will not have the law enforcement officers on the road to write the very citations in which we're trying to raise money for this cause, and the fact accidents could go up and we could be going the wrong way. So that's the only reason I make that comment. I hope it isn't the case, but I'm afraid that is what will happen.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Maurer, did you have one last comment?
I did. Thanks, Madam Chair. Two points. One about the veterans issue. That is Veterans Affairs responsibility. When a soldier comes back and they're injured, that's not the responsibility of the state of Oregon. That is a federal issue that clearly needs to be addressed. So I really, I'm a retired military. Throwing the state into that argument is not the place we need to be. We need to be pushing against the feds to say, you need to take care of the veterans, because they do. They have that responsibility. And that's all of us, but that's still a federal responsibility. The other thing is, it's death by 1,000 cuts. whether it's 6 cents a gallon increase, doubling my license registration fee, whether it's increasing corporate minimums, personal income tax, fee, tax, fee. It's death by a thousand cuts. There is going to be a point where we tip over the balance, and this may not be it, but you know, it's one more cut, and that's simply why I will oppose this bill. Thank you.
I'm just going to respond briefly, but this, people who are driving have an option. They don't need to violate the law, and then they won't be fined.
Process question.
Okay.
Does this go then to Ways and Means?
It goes in Ways and Means, right. So with that, I'm going to close the discussion. And Debbie, would you call the roll call, please? Oh, I need a motion first. Sorry.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3692.
Thanks. Representative Boone moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3692. Debbie, I know if there are going to be any more discussion, which I'm not going to allow. Debbie, would you call the roll?
Brief discussion.
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
No.
Representative Huffman?
No.
Representative Maurer?
No.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
No.
Chair
Tomei. Aye. So the amendments are adopted. Representative Boone.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3692, as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Boone moves House Bill 3692 as amended to the floor with the floor with the due pass recommendation, and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Again, I'm not going to allow any discussion. So the clerk will call the roll. I know. What a.
Representative Ambrose?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
No.
Representative Huffman?
No.
Representative Maurer?
No.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
No.
Chair Tomei?
Aye. The motion passes, and this bill, as amended, is sent to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you. And with that, we will close the House Committee on Human Services Committee.